Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. As usual, I'm joined by Linda, Teresa, Nicola, Heather and Pat.
Hey.
Hi.
And I'm Steph. Today, we're going to hear Nicola read from her work in progress, and then we'll be offering her some critique, just the way we do in our Write Club group meetings. Teresa's going to share her word of the week with us. And later, we're going to be talking to Keziah Frost, whose first novel, The Reluctant Fortune Teller, was published around the same time she celebrated her 60th birthday. And as we'll see, she's in very good company as a late starter. Heather and Laura Wilkinson will round off today's show with their bedside table books. But first, Pat is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Ready?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Okay, first clue. Published in 1939, this was this American author's first novel and introduced the character who would feature in a further 8 novels.
Oh, okay.
A lot of blank faces. It is very vague, that one, isn't it? Anybody got an inkling yet?
No. I think I might know who the author is.
I'm guessing at
but
the author,
but no. I don't know the name of the book.
Okay. The plot, notorious for its complexity, soon spirals into a world of pornography, gambling and Hollywood lowlife. It's not flawless and there are some loose ends. In fact, when Howard Hawks filmed the novel, he asked, "Who killed the chauffeur?" And the author replied that he had no idea. To him, plot was always subordinate to character, mood and atmosphere.
Mm. Yeah. I still think it's the same author, but I don't know the name of the book.
Heather looks puzzled.
Mm.
Okay, third one, which might not actually help you. Might not help Steph, I think. The character was portrayed in numerous films by a variety of actors. James Garner, Robert Mitchum, Elliot Gould, Dick Powell, and most famously Humphrey Bogart.
Mm.
I should imagine that you've got the character and the author, but not necessarily the title of the book.
Yeah. No,
anybody?
Is it Raymond Chandler?
It is Raymond Chandler.
I thought so, but I can't remember the name of the book.
Yeah. Book, I don't know. The Big Easy? No.
Close. His first novel was The Big Sleep.
The Big Sleep.
Right.
Philip Marlowe, his central character, had appeared in short stories that he'd written previously.
Right.
And then what he did was he cannibalised some of his short stories to sort of write the novel. And I chose that one because it fitted in nicely with our theme of late starters. Because, in fact, Raymond Chandler himself was a very late starter and was in his early 40s when he was first published.
Mm-hmm. Very encouraging.
Well, that's brilliant.
Thank you.
Nicola, we're going to hear from your work in progress very shortly. It's fair to say you were a bit of a late starter in fiction, wasn't it?
Yeah, 56. Well, I realised that I had to go back a bit and tell us how Brianne met Alec, the love of her life. This was actually came out of our writing sprint day, and it ended up being my first ever sex scene. But sadly for you lot, I'm only allowed 500 words, so we'll be leaving that bit out today.
Well, that's good, because that means that poor Hannah, whose work often stops her from listening to the podcast if we say anything salacious, should be able to join us this week. Welcome, Hannah.
Yeah, welcome, Hannah. Brianne believed in love at first sight. Oh, you didn't know it was love, not right away, not immediately. But you often felt a premonition, a tingling at the back of your brain. Sometimes your instincts played you wrong, but not often. But you did believe that most of the time, when you met someone who had the potential to be important in your life, you could really feel it on a cellular level. Brianne's particular penchant was for men. So while she often went on to become friends or even business partners in some cases with the women she met and felt that buzz around, she only fell in love with some of the men. There hadn't been that many big momentous love affairs in between kissing the fairly numerous frogs. But looking back, with every single big love of your life kind of affair, any that lasted anyway, she'd known something was special right away. It had been that way with Alec. She'd been having a meeting with her new bank manager in the town she'd just moved to and asked him about good restaurants nearby. She wasn't hopeful, having been spoilt for choice in London. "Oh, you must go to the Acacia just at the end of the road. It's new, but my word, the food is fantastic," he told her. "Actually, if you fancy lunch today, I can take you. My treat. You are a new customer, after all." Actually, John, the business manager of Lloyds Bank in Eastbourne, wasn't bad himself, but Brianne had already found out that he was happily married with two teenage boys. That was not her style at all. So they walked along the road in the early spring sunshine, then ducked into a tiny restaurant that must have been there from Regency times, but had just had a modern refurb. It could only have seated 30 at most downstairs, which was currently completely empty of customers. Not promising. I know, but they are playing 0-7, and like I say, the food is fantastic. Ah, here's Alec, the manager now. A tall, dark-haired man with a huge smile bounced down some tiny steps at the back of the room, only just missing hitting his head on the lintel and holding out his hand to shake John's hand enthusiastically. He looked inquiringly at Brianne, and she immediately felt that frisson of something. Difficult to describe, but definitely physical as well as mental. Like a light buzzing sensation or a small electric shock. Interesting, she thought. While introductions were made, a table selected and starters chosen, she kept quiet, and only when Alec had bounded off upstairs to place their order for scallops with black pudding and samphire did she start to get the story of the restaurant. More particularly, Alec's story. He was a chef too, not just a manager, but as he revealed over the next few months, he'd worked his way up from catering school and had previously run not just one, but four restaurants at a huge multinational company based locally. Then when his friend Eric had secured backing from his rich father to open a restaurant, he'd been tempted away from corporate hospitality to try his hand front of house. John was right, the food was exquisite, way better than Brianne had expected, and the music was very cool. But it was Alec who drew her back to the Acacia regularly with just about anyone she could persuade to eat there. He was so knowledgeable about food and wine, so funny and so up all of the time. He really was the perfect host.
Ah. Nice.
Yeah, good background on Alec. But how do you spell his name? With an X or a C?
Well, it's a C now.
Okay. In the beginning, it was an X. Okay, yeah. And, yeah, I liked very much the introduction to him. I had a couple of questions on the way through. Mm. First, you referred to her having a meeting with her new bank manager in the town. Then in a couple of paragraphs, or the paragraph after next, it's actually John, the business manager of Lloyds Bank in Eastbourne. So is that the same guy?
Yeah, and I don't really need to say any of that, do I?
No. It was very confusing.
Yeah. I could tell it's a fantasy because the bank manager buys lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's semi-autobiographical.
I don't prove that these days, I don't think.
I also see where you say not promising. It's not attributed
to anyone, yeah.
And I wasn't sure who was saying it, you know. And what about the references to things like playing 0-7? I have no idea who that is. I assume it's a band, so I guess that's okay because you're supposed to assume it's a band, right?
Yeah.
Or it is a band.
Yeah, it is a band.
Okay.
I think it's clear that Brianne says not promising because the other guy says, "Here's Alec, the manager now," so he knows him. So I think that's okay.
Yeah. Can I just comment on that as well? It reminds me of, like, pantomime. "And here he comes now." I don't think you needed it. There's another way of...
Or just a tall, dark-haired man.
He's arrived.
Yeah.
And he bounded down and then he bounded up again.
Oh, yeah, did he? Oh, dear. Lots of bounding going on.
No, he bounced down. He bounced down and bounded back.
Okay.
But we did have a lot of bigs at one point.
Oh, right, okay.
As well. And it was big, big, momentous. You don't need... big at all with momentous.
Right.
Yeah.
I was a little bit confused by the movement in time because she sat down and started to get the story.
Mm. Yes.
Then we jumped forward a couple of months.
Yeah.
And then we went back and I didn't know where she'd got the story from because I thought she'd got the story from Alec.
From John.
Mm, right. Oh, from John. So John,
I need
John
to
knows
be more
all
clear.
About
So yeah. he said yeah. she started to get the story of the restaurant, presumably from John.
Yeah.
And then in a couple of sentences further on, as he was a chef too, not just a manager, revealed over the next few months. So that's a little bit confusing. I think we all picked up on the same thing.
I was trying to imply that, you know, they went on to become friends.
But it doesn't get there at all. But also I think, if I can say, that paragraph, he was a chef too, not just a manager,
Was it an info dump for getting?
Well, yes, it is. I've actually put that. But also, it's like, if you're describing two people falling in love, do we really need this CV? Yeah. That's not what falling in love... You know what I mean? That's how I felt a bit. Give me the magic.
Yeah.
Show me the feeling. Yeah. Okay. So I think it's not in the right place, if you don't mind me saying.
And it's probably irrelevant. It's probably just it should have been on the background sheet and not in the...
Maybe. Yeah.
I understand.
I was also a little bit... I understand what you were trying to do, I think. But you know, at the beginning, you say, Brianne believed in love at first sight. Oh, you didn't know it was love. There was suddenly a point of view shift. So you're talking third person about Brianne, and now you're talking directly to the reader.
Right.
And I don't know. Brianne. I think you were trying to say, Brianne thinks, oh, she didn't know it was love.
Yeah.
I don't think it's you as the author talking to the reader, is it?
I think the problem is that it is semi-autobiographical, this bit. Mm. So I think I'm shifting into my head as the author rather than Brianne's head. So point of view is a challenge, an ongoing challenge for me.
Okay. I know what you're saying. I thought it worked okay, that, for me.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was Brianne.
You knew it was Brianne. Yeah, those things. Yeah.
Yeah, but it should be clear.
It's like indirect speech.
Oh, she didn't know it was love at first sight. That's I think all you have to do.
I think it's okay. Brianne believed in love at first sight. Oh, you didn't know it was love. No, that's her thinking, isn't it?
Yeah. That was what it was doing. Okay. But I always find when the author addresses the reader directly.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I think, oh, they knew I was here.
They know I'm here.
They know I'm here, yeah. And I want them to tell me a story.
I think the other challenge that's flagged up for me just this bit is that I speak quite colloquially.
Mm.
I'm trying to sort of find my voice and make it unusual and you know, different.
No, I think you were trying to give us exposition on Brianne's attitudes, her beliefs about love. So I thought that's what you were trying to do.
I think I need to decide every time I sit down to write whose point of view is this from.
Yes.
Because then that'll make it a lot easier to stick to it.
I was just the phrase, you know, in some cases with the women she met and felt that buzz around. Now I know what you're saying, that you have the slight attraction to some of the women, but I just felt the way it was handled was, I just thought that was a bit awkward somehow, if it had been...
I understand, I know what you're missing.
Yeah, I thought that she only fell in love with some of the men was a bit awkward, and I think what you're trying to say is she didn't fall in love with everyone she met, with every man she met, but I thought if you phrased it, she only ever fell in love with men.
Right.
She was sometimes had the same feeling for women, but she only ever fell in love with men.
And I wasn't trying to talk about sexual feeling either, it's more about that. You know, because I've met women the energy. I'm trying to talk about energy, not even sexual energy.
Okay.
I did wonder about the Victorian novel thing with all the capital letters.
Sorry.
Yes, I thought bank manager capitalized didn't seem.
Yeah, there are a few. Right. And the sapphire and black pudding and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's just I'm afraid I'm used to putting things in capitals in my marketing speak. I'll need a good editor.
And I thought, you know, maybe something like when he's not in the room, she's finding it difficult maybe to concentrate on what John is saying because she's, when is he coming back?
Yeah.
You know, there's just like not quite getting that.
Not quite
that
showing enough. Yeah, take that on board completely. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, just the fact that she says to John, oh, so how do you know him then? I mean, would show that she's actually more interested in the chef than she's the bank manager.
Yeah.
And then he could go on to tell the story, couldn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Lots to work on, really.
Okay, thank you, Nicola. That was really great. Now, Teresa, you've got a word of the week for us.
I have, and today I want to talk about a lovely word that I like the sound of, lackadaisical.
Oh,
I just chose it because it's just a nice word, lackadaisical. And from an online site, I found the definition sentimentally woebegone. From the interjection lackadaisy is another version of it. And in the Merriam-Webster online, it says, where does lackadaisical come from? Alas, alack, there are times when life seems to be one unfortunate occurrence after another. We've all had days when nothing seemed to go right. When folks had one of those days back in the 17th century, they'd cry, lack-a-day to express their sorrow and disappointment. Lack-a-day was a shortened form of the expression alack-the-day. In the mid-1700s, lackadaisical was coined through the addition of the suffix ickle. The word lackadaisy also was used around that time as an interjection similar to lack-a-day. And this word, though never as prevalent as lack-a-day, might have influenced the coinage of lackadaisical. But the other thing that interests me about lackadaisical, a bit like mischievous, it's starting to change. It's morphing into a new word, lackadaisical, which we hear lackadaisical, because it's got mixed up with lax.
Yeah.
And so, like mischievous, lackadaisical does not yet pass spell checkers. It's not recognised as an actual word, but probably it will be in the dictionary someday soon because it's becoming more common. So, lackaday, when you've had a bad day and you're feeling lackadaisical.
Well, I've learned something today. Brilliant. I thought it was completely different to what I thought it meant. I thought it meant something along the lines of happy-go-lucky, laid-back, carefree.
That's what I thought.
Well, languid and languorous are sort of synonyms. So, yes, it is a bit like that, but not in the cheerful, happy-go-lucky sense.
Okay.
It's like careless. If you say
carelessness.
Yes, careless. Yeah, if you've been lackadaisical about your homework, you haven't really bothered. Yes. You've done the absolute minimum. And
it's a sort of word you might use as a teacher in a kid's report, isn't it?
That's probably what lackadaisical attitude.
Or lackadaisical.
Oh, lackadaisical.
That's probably what I know. So if you're an English teacher, geography teachers can be forgiven for lackadaisical. That's lovely. That's lovely. Thank you very much. Now, Heather and I were very lucky to meet Keziah Frost a little while ago, so let's listen to that interview now. We're delighted to welcome Keziah Frost to Write Club, the podcast. Keziah is the author of The Reluctant Fortune Teller, her debut novel, which was published in March of 2018 by HarperCollins, Harlequin and Park Row Books, when Keziah was 59 years old. Although she decided at the age of 10 that she wanted to write novels, her life led her on a different path, including work as a painter of pet portraits, bilingual domestic violence case manager, and even now she continues to work as a psychotherapist alongside her writing. Keziah's storytelling has been described as charming, warm and wittily told, and the Richmond, Virginia Book Review said, "The Reluctant Fortune Teller will steal a bit of your time and your heart." I must say, I'm thoroughly enjoying Norbert and his friends. They're really quirky characters, full of humour, and they've reminded me that as we grow older, we can still enjoy personal growth and new experiences. So, Keziah, welcome to Write Club, the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I am thrilled and honoured to be here, and you're starstruck. I listen to you every episode and get so much benefit from your program. The reader recommendations as well as the advice to writers is very helpful.
Brilliant. We're very glad
to be here. Yeah.
As we've heard, life got in the way of your writing for a while. When did you start to write seriously?
You know, I tried in the 90s, but I was raising a family at the time and there were lots of interruptions and there wasn't the internet. So I have to say the internet was a huge help to me this time when I got started again in writing. Well, when I started writing this book, I was actually, it began with a short story, and I was probably 58 or 59 when I started writing this short story. And it had quirky characters who were all in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and they were all into all kinds of drama with each other and power struggles, and it was humorous. And I was having such a good time with it. And my daughter, who is in her 30s, she was reading it along with me. And she said, "Why don't you write a story about a fortune teller who doesn't believe in the fortunes, and yet they keep coming true?" And I thought, bingo, that's it. So I started taking these characters out of my short story. And in the short story, there was a very controlling, manipulative woman who's always planning to take over everything. And I thought, she'll be my fortune teller. And then I thought, no, that's too obvious. I should pick the least likely person. So the least likely person was a very shy, retired accountant who didn't believe in any kind of hocus pocus at all. And nobody had ever noticed him and nobody ever listened to his suggestions. And I, he's my fortune teller. So that from there, the book just started growing.
So that's Norbert, the reluctant
fortune teller. That's
Norbert. Yeah. And he's 73.
Yes.
Do you know Norbert? I mean, did you have an inspiration for Norbert?
You know, I don't, of course. It's not a real person, but, you know, he's a very gentle man. And my father-in-law was a very gentle man. And he also was an accountant. And he was very quiet. And everybody else did the talking. And I think probably there's a lot of him in Norbert. Mm-hmm. Probably that was a real-life model. But then Norbert has a lot of other aspects to him that are different.
Yes, and his chihuahua.
And his chihuahua, yes.
Oh, she's so sweet. So did you deliberately set out to explore older protagonists, or was it just something that happened?
I think it was something that just happened. I just, I started writing about these characters who would be in all this drama with each other, and it just seemed to me that they would probably be retired and of a certain age. I wasn't really thinking about their age very much. I wasn't really thinking, oh, now I'm going to write about older people. But once I did, and I shared it with my writers group, well, my writers group is composed mostly of older people, and they got very excited and said, we don't get to read about ourselves. You know, it's as if all the protagonists are in their 30s and 40s, but it is really nice to read about older characters who are the central characters, who are not, you know, playing a supporting role. And it's about them and their growth, their development, who they're going to become next. So I think, you know, as now I'm 61, I'm thinking, I want to read that kind of book too. I want to read books about how, I heard Jane Fonda interviewed the other night, and she said, it's never too late to become who you were supposed to be. And I don't think she's the first person that said that. That's probably actually what I was saying in my book too, and what people have said for many years, but we mustn't forget that.
No, and that's the discussion really that we've been having today about the late starters, mm-hmm. the people that come to writing late. So,
well, I'm almost 65 and I'm very, very much a novice.
yes, and there are so many writers who did get a later start.
Mm.
I think Sherwood Anderson and Wallace Stevens, to think of some Americans.
Yeah.
Laura Ingalls Wilder. Well, there's a long list.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Little House on the Prairie.
Yes.
You clearly had to do some research about fortune telling. How did you learn? How did you, find out?
Well, Heather, actually, I didn't have to do a bit of research because I grew up with a fortune telling mother.
Fantastic.
Really, I did. And so as I was growing up, she used to teach all of these arcane arts to me. And I kind of assumed that all the moms up and down the street were reading fortunes all the time because my mom did. So we used to read the tea leaves. I think she started with me when I was about 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
Tea leaves, cards, astrology, numerology, handwriting analysis, automatic writing. Whatever I'm forgetting, she did that too. All of it. All of it. I mean, she loved ghosts. She loved everything. And so that was something that we really shared. It was kind of a bonding thing. And I do remember that when I was about 5 or 6, there were some neighbors who were just lovely. It was a Dutch couple, and they lived about 4 houses down, Mr. and Mrs. Kuiper. And I used to go and visit them, and they used to give me lots of attention. So as a 5-year-old, I loved that. And one day my best friend came over, and she had a book. It was a brand new book called Eloise, The Little Girl Who Goes to Live in the Plaza Hotel. It was a big classic. And she was getting a lot of attention for it. So I thought, well, she's not going to take my pseudo grandparents and get their attention. I'm going to go home and get a book too. Apparently what you have to do is get a book. So I ran home, and my mother had this big coffee table book called the Coffee Table Book of Palm Reading. So I brought it over to the Kuipers to show them. And it was beautiful, black book. It had a big palm on the front, and it had all kinds of illustrations. And Mrs. Kuiper looked at this book, and she just backed away, and she just went on watering her flowers and didn't. And then Mr. Kuiper sat down in the lawn chair, and he was leafing through it, and he kept saying, Camille, look at this. And she said, I will not look at that, and you shouldn't either. And I knew that I'd done something wrong, but I couldn't figure out what it was. And then I brought the book home, and I told my mother what I'd done, and she hit the roof and said, you did not show that to the neighbors. Oh, no, they'll all be talking about us. They won't like us anymore. You don't know what you've done. So then I felt, oh, my gosh, so not everybody's into this. This is like an unusual thing, I guess. So
at the back of the book, you've got the what each of the cards mean. Is that something that's sort of generic, or is it something that, you've devised?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, it is devised for the book. So at the beginning of every chapter, there's a little bit saying, this card means such and such, because it gives you foreshadowing for what's going to happen in the chapter. Mm. Well, of course, I had to, I had to create my own meanings for the card so it would line up with what was happening in the chapters. Mm. However, you can really use it as a card reading guide, because people do it and it works out. At one book signing, they asked me if I would read cards for people. I had to really think about that for a while. Like, do I want to be known as a card reader or as a novelist? But just for fun, I read cards for some people, and they were all saying, oh my gosh, it's it's so true. How did you know?
That's what an interesting thing that one of the characters, the lady, says to Norbert. Oh, don't worry, because people will forget all the misses, but they'll really major on the hits that you make. Was it Carlotta or one of
Yes, you? Carlotta probably. Yeah, it does work somewhat like that too. Yeah. People will read into it what they need, sort of like a Rorschach test,
Yeah.
People read into it what applies to them.
Yeah.
And it can be helpful to people, I guess. But I don't know where I stand on the whole fortune telling thing, if it's a good thing or a bad thing or a true thing or a false thing. I kind of try to leave that open.
It's great fun in the book. It's great. We're really enjoying it. Now, so you were 59. You thought, I'll just write a book. So you did. You had some support from the writers group. I know that you joined a Faber Academy course online, so you've got lots of input from people there. So you finally finished your manuscript. What happened when it came to finding an agent and a publisher?
Well, I think because I've heard you talk about it, finding an agent is every bit as difficult as finding a publisher. And even when you find an agent, you're still only halfway there, because your agent's going to have to sell it. So how I did it was, there's a website called MSWL, Manuscript Wish List, and then there's a hashtag. And I went on there where it lists all the agents. This would be a U.S. thing, I suppose. So if you're approaching U.S. agents, well, agents list themselves and say what they're looking for right now. So that's hugely helpful, because you don't want to send your, adult literary fiction book to an agent who only represents children's picture books. You want to be targeting your book exactly to the people who want to sell that kind of book. So that's how I found my agent. And her name is Danielle Bukowski. She's wonderful. And she's in New York. And I was drawn to her profile because she said she was looking for books. She said, a strict adherence to reality is not required. So I liked her right away. But actually, I sent it out to about 40 agents. Wow. And I got some interest from a few. Mm. Two of them said something very strange. Two of them said to me, I like your book. Let us know if anybody else shows any interest in it. Wasn't that strange? So that wasn't a very nice response, because it was like, if a boy says to a girl, I think I might want to date you. Let me know if any other guys like you. But there was a little bit of interest. Some people wanted to see more. But I really, really liked this particular agent, because what she said right away was, you told me in your query letter that you were going to write about Norbert, but when I read your first 50 pages, it looks like you're writing just as much about Carlotta. So you need to decide who you're writing about. If you decide to do any revisions, let me know. Mm. So of course, that weekend was all revisions, and I got it back to her as quick as I could, focused on Norbert. And then apparently she liked what she saw, and we started working together after that. Because you really do have to be very open. You know, if somebody has a criticism for you, especially if it's somebody who really knows, like an agent, you really do have to be open to changing and adapting, because they're professionals and, you know, usually their advice is right.
They know what the publishers will want, and they know what they can sell and what they can't. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, Keziah, is that your real name?
No, it's not. Uh-huh. No, I chose that name, actually. I have a pen name for my fiction, and then I use my real name for nonfiction. I'm a psychotherapist by trade, and so I did write one self-help book, and I self-published that one. And so I thought it would be best to keep my two professional lives separate from each other to avoid confusion.
So why did you choose Keziah? Why did that name come to you?
You know, it's a strange first name, isn't it? When I was a teenager, I used to go to an old cemetery. It was a Revolutionary era cemetery. And, you know, in the United States, we don't have very many very old things. But, you know, Revolutionary, like the 1700s, that's really, really old for us. So I was very drawn to it. And I would walk around and look at the stones. And, you know, the stones of that time, sometimes they have a little description of the person's life, their biography, how they died, something like that. So I love this place. And there were a lot of Keziahs there. It was a name that was in fashion at the time, along with the Hezekiahs and Hebzekiahs and Uriahs and all those kinds of things. So I always remembered that name. There was a child buried in the cemetery and her name was Keziah. And I think I probably was, you know, I felt drawn to that because I was a child myself. So I always remembered that name and just thought it was a good one. And then, of course, when I thought, well, if I'm going to use Keziah as a first name, the last name has to be simple, one syllable, makes an image, sounds kind of literary. Frost seemed like that would be a good name to go with it.
Brilliant.
That's the story.
That's a lovely story. A lovely story. So what's next for Keziah Frost?
Well, right now I am working on the beginning of a mystery series. I probably put a lot of pressure on myself, and it probably is the age thing, actually. I do have in the back of my mind, I'm getting a late start, so I have to, you know, write fast. So, yeah, I take it very seriously. It's about 6 days a week, probably about 4 hours a day.
Wow.
I've been surprised at how much emotional energy it takes to write. I never really thought about it until now, but it really does. You can feel very tired or drained if you are writing on a regular basis to the kind of schedule that's suggested. If you want to get somewhere, you're going to need to get serious. You're going to need to make a schedule. That all makes sense. But I wasn't expecting to be tired, because all you do is sit in a chair and write. What could be tiring? It's not like working in the fields or something. But emotionally, it is very tiring. It takes a lot of concentration. Self-care is very important. You have to take care of yourself. I think it's important to be aware of it, because it's not so obvious that it would take a lot of energy from you. But I mean, it's also my greatest joy. I have so much fun with it.
Well, that's been awesome. Thank you so much for your time. We've really loved having you.
And you're welcome.
Oh, that was really interesting. She's in good company, isn't she?
Yeah, as a late starter.
What late starters can you think of?
Well, I have a favourite author, Isaac Dinesen, and she was probably nearly 50 when her first seven Gothic tales were published in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And she's quite interesting about growing old age in many ways, because you may know that she was the author of Out of Africa as well, about her experience of living in Africa. And in the end, the coffee farm failed and she spent her latter years in Denmark longing to be in Africa. But at one point she talks about growing old without the consolation of witchcraft. By which I think she meant, I take it to mean, in Africa, as women were past their child bearing age and past perhaps their useful life, they then were endowed with magic or with wisdom and qualities like that, which in Europe she felt, as many people feel, once women get beyond a certain age that they're of no account or no interest.
That's interesting.
Well, Mary Wesley's another one. She was first published when she was 70. Her first adult novel was published when she was 70, and her books all came out between the ages of 70 and 79.
Oh, that's very encouraging.
Yeah. Isn't it just?
I was just going to say, is it because it's a combination of life experience and time to actually reflect on and do something with?
Yeah, I think
all this wealth of experience that you've gained.
For our generation, it's not so much that being past your useful years or past your child-rearing years, because I didn't have 13 children like my grandmother, but we're perhaps at the point where the mortgage is paid off and we've got more free time. It's a different kind of
scenario. Not so focused on careers.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And
so
children.
Teresa, when did you start seriously writing?
Less than 10 years ago, so I would say probably in my early 50s, thought about it. Because I do have a lot of free time. I'm very lucky in that respect, and I can remember friends saying to me, so are you writing a novel? And I'm like, no, I don't want to write a novel. I just want to read novels. But then something got me, a story, an idea got me, and then I wanted to write and to explore that. Mm. So, yeah, I would say definitely a late starter.
And Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes, Angela's Ashes was published when he was 66.
Mm. Mm.
So, you know, there's hope for me.
Well, there's hope for all of us, because I found an article from an English newspaper published in April this year. War Hero becomes one of UK's oldest published authors at the age of 97. So we've got 34 years.
We've got time.
So he wrote his memoirs whilst in a care home. Former Flight Lieutenant Humphrey Phillips, who served in 103 Squadron during the war. So
that's
there's hope for us all, I think.
Incredible.
So, yeah. Pat, do you think being older makes you a better writer, your life experience?
Me personally, or are we talking about generally?
Both.
Are we talking about improving your punctuation as you get older?
It's like when I was talking the other week about reading Normal People, and it's written by, I think she's about 23, 24, Sally Rooney, the author. I think in a sense, when I started reading it, I was prepared to be quite dismissive, that sort of, you know, what can she know? And of course, it didn't apply at all. It's a lovely book, beautifully written. So I'm not sure that age and experience actually does necessarily make you a better writer.
And you obviously were an English teacher, so you were involved in creative writing your whole working life.
Yeah.
So it must have been a lifelong passion that you're still doing it now.
Yeah, it's as I think I've said before, it was always at the back of my mind, and it's what I said earlier, it's now having more time.
I think it's quite disheartening when you read that, you know, some undergraduate has got a 3-book deal, you know, and they haven't actually written a word yet. So, you know, it is quite heartening to know that many people find their stride later in life, you know. So it's never too late.
And Heather, you a self-proclaimed very late starter.
Very, very late. Yes, almost 65 and I've not read anything. I mean, I never had any pretensions whatsoever of writing, never thought about writing, never crossed my mind that I would be able to. And it was only being a volunteer at the hospice that started me off. I volunteered at the therapeutic writing group and, you know, as I've said before, I thought I'd be making the tea. And I started writing. And it's only since joining you ladies and the idea of writing something that I know and writing about my career. And,
but isn't it great that age is no barrier to learning new skills skills and so on? It's wonderful.
I might even learn about semicolons when I'm 65.
I'm not sure I'm ever going to get those. But
I won't either. I can't use them because I never know where to place them.
And Linda, you were involved in publishing and editing and working with words.
Yes.
A huge part of your career, wasn't
I was. However, it wasn't what you would think of as creative writing. Although, as a child, I remember writing stories. I wrote a song. I found some of these things in my mother's scrapbook after she died. And then I went on, you know, always thinking about loving to write. So I don't think I would count as a late starter, but I'm a very late finisher.
Excellent. Well, you know, I'm very much like a lot of you in that I now have a little bit more time to focus. And I did write and read a lot as a child, and I was always writing plays and forcing everybody to come and watch me perform. I was the star, the director, the writer a lot. But then, of course, life took over and I had to earn a living. So it's very much something that I've always wanted to do but come back to. And, you know, we'd love to hear from you out there. What brought you to creative writing? Is it something you've done all your life, or is it something you're making more time for now? So get onto our Facebook group and tell us a bit more about you. Okay, before we wrap up, Heather, what's on your bedside table?
Well, we had visitors last week and I was given a gift, the new Patti Smith book called Devotion. And I have covered one of Patti Smith's books before. I read My Train, I think, sometime last year. But in this stirring book, one of our culture's most inspiring artists offers an intimate account of her own creative process. Patti Smith presents an original and beautifully crafted tale of obsession. A young skater who lives for her art, a possessive collector who ruthlessly seeks his prize, a relationship forged of need, both craven and exalted. A companion essay makes tangible the mysterious sources of the disquieting tale. Illumination comes as Smith journeys to the south of France to Camus House, tracks down Simone Weil's grave in an Ashford cemetery on the outskirts of London, and haunts the winding nameless streets of Patrick Modaniot's Paris, whether writing in a cafe or on a train. Smith generously opens her notebooks and lets us glimpse the alchemy of her work in this arresting book on writing and why we write.
Oh, fantastic. Can I borrow it, please?
And you finish. Lovely. Thank you. And Laura Wilkinson, we're going to hear what's on her bedside table.
Today we're going to hear from Laura Wilkinson, author of Skin Deep, Redemption Song, Public Battles, Private Wars, and The Family Line. So, Laura, what's on your bedside table?
On my bedside table, the book that I'm reading right now is All My Puny Sorrows by Miriam Toews, I think is how you pronounce it, a Canadian author. And it's a novel, but I understand that it's based quite heavily on her own life experience. It's the story of two sisters, Yoli and Elf, Elfrida. Elf has everything. You know, she's beautiful. She's a world-famous piano player, plays all over the world. She's married to a man who absolutely adores her, but she wants to kill herself. She doesn't want to live anymore. And Yoli is the younger sister, and her life is a bit of a mess. She's divorced. She's got two quite troublesome teenage children, a boy and a girl. She's going through a whole series of failed relationships, or sleeping, having sex with unsuitable men. And she doesn't really have a career to speak of, but she's desperate to keep her sister alive. And it's about their relationship and the impact of the Mennonite community in which they grew up, which I think this is the bit that's based on Miriam Toews' real life experience, because she grew up in a Mennonite community, which I don't know very much about, really. It's more literary than I would usually read. On the whole, the books that I tend to read are more commercial, I would say, or kind of book clubby, really. So they're kind of easy to read. But she writes like a dream, and despite the subject matter, it's actually really funny. It's sad as well. It sounds a really odd thing to say, but it is really funny, and her observations on life are very witty.
And that's all we have time for today, I'm afraid. We hope you've enjoyed listening as much as we've enjoyed recording. Please keep your contributions coming. You can post in the Facebook group. Just look for Write Club the Podcast. Or if you'd like to tell us what's on your bedside table or make a contribution to Word of the Week, you can do that too. Just make a recording and email it to us at contributions@writeclubthepodcast.com. We'll put details on the Facebook group. But please get involved, and please tell all your friends about us too. Goodbye for now.
Bye. Bye.